The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the August 14th issue of the August 14th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine. The main stories and how they were covered. Obama's big climate change push. What happened? President Obama this week unveiled what he called the biggest, most important step we've ever taken to combat climate change. New regulations that will set the first limits on carbon dioxide emissions from the nation's power plants. The initiative, a revamped version of the Clean Power Plan proposed last year, would slash national carbon emissions 32% below 2005 levels by 2030, and it would transform the way the U.S. generates electricity, speeding a shift from dirty coal-fired plants to cleaner natural gas and renewables such as solar and wind power. The Environmental Protection Agency has given each state its own specific carbon reduction goal, but states will have broad discretion in how to reach that target, switching to renewables, for example, or enacting carbon cap-and-trade systems. Obama intends to use the new regulations to pressure other countries to commit to steep reductions in their own emissions ahead of the United Nations summit in Paris in December, where a global treaty to tackle climate change is expected to be signed. But the president's plan will face fierce resistance at home. Republicans, especially from coal states, have vowed to fight the initiative in Congress and the courts. In Kentucky, these regulations would likely mean fewer jobs, shuttered power plants, and higher electricity costs for families and businesses, said Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who has written to all 50 state governors, urging them to ignore the EPA rules. What the editorial said. McConnell and other opponents of these destructive mandates are doing the right thing, said NationalReview.com. This is a classic example of Obama's executive overreach. The president believes he can hand down statements from on high about the day-to-day operations of American businesses. Also, he can ride into Paris on a white charger. It's regulation without representation, said the Wall Street Journal, and it will cost the economy at least $50 billion a year, according to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The plan is a tax on the livelihood of every American, which makes it all the more extraordinary that it is essentially one man's order. There is nothing radical about these sensible, necessary regulations, said the New York Times. The new rules simply codify and accelerate a decade-long energy trend. Carbon emissions have been dropping steadily because of a shift from coal to abundant, low-cost natural gas and a sharp rise in wind and solar power. The plan is flexible and workable, and along with new fuel efficiency standards for motor vehicles, it will bolster the president's credibility and leverage with other nations. What the columnist said. America will pay a steep price for Obama's attempt to win favor with environmental zealots, said Betsy McCaughey in AmericanSpectator.org. Nationwide, about 40% of electric power is still produced by coal plants, and Heritage Foundation economists predict that shuttering them will burn consumers with higher electric bills and send hundreds of thousands of jobs up in smoke, all to avoid what the EPA estimates will be a 0.02 degrees Celsius increase in global temperatures by 2100. You must be kidding. But the fact remains that King coal is dying of natural causes, said Michael Bloomberg in BloombergView.com. Market forces, technological improvements, and the public's demand for action on poisonous pollution and climate change have combined to make alternative sources of energy more attractive. The price of new wind power, for example, is lower than that of coal in most parts of the country. Obama's plan will merely ensure that in the so-called war on coal, really a battle against its harmful effects, the American people emerge victorious. That is, if the measures survive beyond Obama's presidency, said Jonathan Cohn in HuffingtonPost.com. Should a Republican win the 2016 election, the new president could thwart the regulations in myriad ways or even rescind them entirely. A coal-friendly White House could pack federal courts with coal-friendly judges or install a hand-chosen EPA that could override Obama's rules with new ones. This plan to reduce emissions might well prove to be a cornerstone of Obama's climate change legacy. But that depends on the Oval Office's next occupant. Our controversy of the week: Cecil the Lion. Why his killing sparked so much outrage. Cecil was no ordinary cat, said the New York Times in an editorial. Until his horrifying death, this magnificent 13-year-old black-maned lion was a star attraction at Zimbabwe's Hwange National Park and the patriarch of a large pride of cubs and lionesses. But that was before Walter Palmer, a dentist from Minnesota, paid $54,000 to a team of local guides who lured Cecil from the protected sanctuary of the park. Palmer promptly shot the majestic lion with a crossbow, but didn't kill him, forcing the hunters to stalk Cecil for 40 hours before dispatching him with a gunshot and cutting off his head and skin as a trophy for Palmer. As news of Cecil's killing spread last week, Palmer became the target of international fury, said Wayne Pacell in CNN.com. After issuing a hollow apology that blamed everything on his guides, the bloodthirsty dentist is now in hiding. His practice is shuttered, and officials in Zimbabwe are calling for his extradition. Let Palmer's public shaming serve as a warning to all those wannabe Hemingways who would feed their egos and fill their dens with the blank stares of dead animals. Spare me the ridiculous, farcical, and sanctimonious hypocrisy, said Brett Ahrens in MarketWatch.com. Most of those baying for Palmer's blood think nothing of eating eggs and meat produced by the U.S.'s barbaric factory farms. You meat eaters support an industry whose business model involves subjecting tens of millions of animals to lives and deaths of nightmarish horror. People argue that killing farm animals is different, said Frank Miniter in Forbes.com, because the African lion is rare and killing one serves no purpose. But big game hunting can manage animal populations for the benefit of the entire ecosystem, providing money for the protection and welfare of thousands of animals. Sorry to sound so speciesist, says Eliyahu Fetterman in the New York Daily News, but where's our outrage over the fellow human beings who get murdered, raped, and mutilated every day all around the world? Suffering humans get not even a fraction of the empathy being lavished on a single animal. I've little sympathy for the appalling Dr. Palmer, said Rod Dreher in the AmericanConservative.com, but let's get our moral priorities straight. On social media, a frenzied mob is clamoring for Palmer's arrest or hanging at the very same time that most Americans are ignoring videos revealing Planned Parenthood officials coolly negotiating fees for the tiny organs of aborted fetuses. Cecil's death has unleashed a cross-ideological epidemic of whataboutism, said Brian Beutler in NewRepublic.com, Conservatives and liberals are demanding to know why people seem to care more about the death of one lion than about abortion, poverty, meat-eating, police killings of black men, Donald Trump's racism, etc. The answer is that those much weightier issues involve a level of moral complexity that the killing of Cecil simply doesn't. There is no gray area in the cowardly killing of a protected lion. No possible upside, and people are right to be disturbed by it. Perhaps so, but was the reaction really proportional to Palmer's alleged crime? Asked Heather Wilhelm in RealClearPolitics.com. In the digital age, we now have a weekly ritual cleansing in which some poor sap does something stupid or politically incorrect and is identified as the new world's most despicable person. Then mobs of wild-eyed, unhinged keyboard cops sweep in to judge, shame, excoriate, and try to take away the offender's livelihood and ruin his life. Hunting may be the cruelest sport, but it's becoming awfully fashionable. It was a good week for liking it hot. After researchers in China found that people who eat a diet rich in spicy foods such as curry and fresh chili pepper can reduce their chances of premature death by up to 14%. It was a good week for textbook salesmen after an NBC News report revealed that the average cost of college textbooks has risen 1,041% in the past 38 years, triple the overall rate of inflation. Thanks to the captive market of customers required to buy assigned books. And it was a good week for human-cyborg relations after British sex expert Helen Driscoll declared that robophilia, or sex between humans and robots, will be considered the norm within the next 50 years. But it was also a bad week for human-cyborg relations after Hitchbot, a talking hitchhiking robot trekking across the country as part of a social science experiment, was found in Philadelphia with its head and arms torn off. I just think somebody probably came out of a bar and was drunk and beat the crap out of it, said a Philly police detective. It was a bad week for Simon Dominguez, a marathon swimmer who was forced to abandon his quest to become the first to swim the 28 miles from San Francisco to the Farallon Islands when his support staff spotted a great white shark circling him. It was hard to quit, a disappointed Dominguez said, but a shark is a shark. And it was a bad week for power couples. After Kermit the Frog and Miss Piggy announced that they are splitting up after a nearly 40-year romance. Our personal lives are now distinct and separate, the couple said in a joint statement. We will be seeing other people, pigs, frogs, et al. Turning to the briefing page now, exporting radical Islam. Saudi Arabia has spent billions promoting its extremist version of Islam. What has it wrought? Why do the Saudis proselytize? To combat the spread of Shiite Islam and ensure that the Islamic world is primarily Sunni. In recent years, the ancient Sunni-Shiite conflict in Iraq, Yemen, and throughout the Middle East has grown more overt, bitter, and violent. Now that Iran has agreed to rein in its nuclear program in return for the lifting of international economic sanctions, Riyadh fears a newly enriched Tehran will be more aggressive in spreading its Shiite doctrine and promoting Shiite-led revolutions. a trove of Saudi diplomatic documents covering 2010 to 2015, recently released by WikiLeaks, shows a Saudi obsession with Iranian actions and Iranian influence. Saudi government agencies monitor Iranian cultural and religious activities and try to muzzle Shiite influence by shutting down or blocking access to Iranian-backed media. Saudi diplomats keep close tabs on Iranian involvement everywhere, from Tajikistan, which has a strong historical Persian ties, to China, where the tiny beleaguered Uyghur population, which is Muslim, is growing more religious. How do the Saudis promote their religious views? By investing heavily in building mosques, madrasas, schools, and Sunni cultural centers across the Muslim world. Indian intelligence says that in India alone, from 2011 to 2013, some 25,000 Saudi clerics arrived bearing more than $250 million to build mosques and universities and hold seminars. We are talking about thousands and thousands of activist organizations and preachers who are in the Saudi sphere of influence, says Usama Hassan, a researcher in Islamic studies. These institutions and clerics preach the specifically Saudi version of Sunni Islam, the extreme fundamentalist strain known as Wahhabism or Salafism. What is Wahhabism? Founded in the 18th century by Muslims seeking a return to Quranic literalism, Wahhabism is one of the strictest sects of Islam. The founder, Sheikh Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, sought the protection of an emir, Muhammad ibn Saud, and the two joined forces to spread the doctrine throughout the Arabian Peninsula. The cleric's daughter married the emir's son, which means the entire house of Saud is directly descended from Wahhab. The purist sect requires adherents to abstain from alcohol and drugs. The sexes are segregated, with women fully covered in public. Even other Muslims who stray from these medieval practices, such as Shiites and moderate Sunni sects, are considered infidels. Prescribed punishment for crimes, among them apostasy and blasphemy, include flogging, stoning, and beheading. How did it become so strong? A turning point came in 1979 when radical clerics who believed the House of Saud had been contaminated with Western decadence led hundreds of armed militants to occupy the Grand Mosque in Mecca. Deeply alarmed, the royal family sought to appease the militants by reversing the steps taken toward modernity the country had taken. Movie theaters and record stores were shut down, and more power was given to the religious police to seek out and punish offenses. In effect, said former diplomat John Burgess, the seizure of the Grand Mosque sent Saudi Arabia into a 30-year time warp that cut it off from the social development trajectory it had been on. The royal family made a grand bargain with the clerics. Riyadh would fund the spread of Wahhabism abroad as long as the extremists kept any militant activities off Saudi soil. That deal ensured that radical Islam would overwhelm moderate versions in many countries and planted the seeds of many terrorist groups. Where has Wahhabism reached? Nearly everywhere in the Muslim world except where Iran holds sway. In the 1980s, Saudi money and fighters poured into Afghanistan to help the Mujahideen fight the Soviets, an effort that gave rise to the Taliban and eventually to Al-Qaeda. In the 1990s, Saudi aid to the Bosnian Muslims struggling in the wars that broke up Yugoslavia brought the Wahhabi strain of Islam to Europe. That same decade, Saudi money helped to further radicalize Chechnya's Muslims. One of the cables released by WikiLeaks quotes then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, "Donors in Saudi Arabia constitute the most significant source of funding to Sunni terrorist groups worldwide. Most members of Al-Qaeda were Saudi, including Osama bin Laden and 15 of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 were Saudis. Where does ISIS fit into this picture? The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria sees itself as purer than the Saudi regime, but its fundamentalist Sunni doctrine has its roots in Wahhabism. Bob Graham, a former Democratic senator from Florida, who has called for declassification of the portion of the 9/11 Commission report dealing with the Saudi Arabian links to the hijackers, says ISIS is a product of Saudi ideals, Saudi money, and Saudi organizational support. In effect, Graham says, ISIS represents a form of Wahhabi ideology that the Saudis can't control, a cancer that now threatens the kingdom. Who serves as fuel for ISIS? Our own youth, said Saudi dissident writer Turki al-Hamad this year. In order to stop ISIS, you must first dry up this ideology at the source. The Madrasas' impact. During the decade-long Afghan struggle against the Soviets, Saudi princes funded the explosive growth of madrasas in Pakistan and Afghanistan. The schools, located in rural communities where there was no other source of education, taught a militant form of Islam, telling students they had a sacred duty to fight infidels. Out of those schools came the radical students who eventually formed the Taliban, as well as many Al-Qaeda recruits. Today, many of these Pakistani schools draw students from Nigeria, Indonesia, Malaysia, and elsewhere, and they return home radicalized. The ideology that's propagated by these schools is so significant in shaping minds in the Muslim world, said political scientist Vali Nasser of Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. If regular schooling is not schooling people, and schools that propagate fanaticism are schooling people, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to figure out what would be the impact. We'll take a look now at the columns, the first two from the U.S. Sanders' Progressive Paradise. Bernie Sanders wants to bring Vermont's model to all of America, said Jeffrey Norman, but voters may want to look at the results first. Progressive Vermont is the vanguard of all liberal causes, including the $15 minimum wage, the labeling of genetically modified foods, and single-payer health care. Democratic Governor Peter Shumlin made the adoption of single-payer or socialized health care the centerpiece of his 2010 campaign, and Sanders was one of his biggest cheerleaders. But single-payer is now dead due to sticker shock. After 4 years of trying to figure out how to pay for free health care for all, Shumlin and liberal lawmakers concluded that the state would have to impose an 11.5% payroll tax and a state income tax with a top rate of 9.5%. Even then, projections showed the system running in the red by 2020. So much for single payer. Progressive promises of free health care and free college education always sound nice in the abstract until taxpayers realize they're stuck with the bill. Scalia's corrosive insults. Justice Antonin Scalia's apoplectic dissents are debasing the Supreme Court, said David Kravitz. Every time his conservative wing loses a major decision, such as those on gay marriage and Obamacare, Scalia expresses his fury and contempt in personal, unnecessarily antagonistic terms. Take, for example, his mockery of Justice Anthony Kennedy's heartfelt opinion on gay marriage, saying it resembled the mystical aphorisms of the fortune cookie, and that if he, Scalia, were in any way associated with it, I would hide my head in a bag. Scalia's dissents get attention not only because he dismisses majority rulings in such colorful language, jiggery-pokery, applesauce, argle-bargle, but also because it's shocking to hear a Supreme Court justice treating his colleagues with such profound disrespect. These petty insults belong on talk radio or cable TV, not in the nation's highest court, where justices used to rely on compelling legal argument to point out supposed flaws in the majority's ruling. Scalia's vitriolic dissents have become the judicial equivalent of pornography, admittedly titillating, but also coarsening and degrading. And here's a column from Russia. It says, Moscow wasn't built for cars. Moscow is the most congested city on the planet, said Helene Richard. While it has fewer cars than Istanbul or Rio de Janeiro, the city was not designed for automobile transport and simply can't cope with it. During the Cold War, only the well-connected owned private cars. But once the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, the market opened up, and everyone who could afford a car bought one. The only place for all these vehicles to go is the grand Soviet-era boulevards, which were designed for massive military parades. These huge avenues became stagnant parking lots during rush hour, as there are few feeder roads or alternative routes. Everything gets funneled through the center of Moscow, right by the Kremlin. The traffic isn't helped by the fact that Russians tend to be careless drivers, which explains why car crashes and fatalities are so much more common here than in the rest of Europe. Our elites are the biggest road hogs of all. Government officials abuse their flashing blue lights to cut through traffic, and many Russians buy black market lights so they can pose as officials. Still, in an epic Moscow traffic jam like the 2008 standstill that stretched 40 miles and lasted 13 hours, even police cars can't get through. Turn now to the last word, titled this week, Clearly Wonderful. Judges at the Oscars of Water sip and sniff dozens of samples, said John Lingen, to find the world's best H2O. Arthur von Weissenberger's graying hair was combed behind his ears, and his yellow tie matched his gleaming gold cufflinks. With a practiced, calm authority befitting his baronial name, his grandfather was an Austrian aide-de-camp, von Weissenberger looked out at the 10 men and women seated in front of him and explained the day's mission to us. We're here today to determine what tastes good in water, he said. We were gathered in the most resplendent venue in Berkeley Springs, West Virginia, population 613, the Parkview Garden Room of the town's country inn. As von Weissenberger spoke, hotel employees were stringing LED globes along the low ceiling at banquet hall's rafter, preparing for the 25th annual Berkeley Springs International Water Tasting. This is the so-called Oscars of Water. Von Weissenberger, the foremost bottled water expert on Earth and author of multiple books on the subject, has served as watermaster since the event's inception, and he was attending to his most essential duty of the weekend, training the panel of judges who would soon perform a blind taste test to choose the best waters from a field of 84. There are industry awards that honor all varieties of food and beverages, but no other event has focused solely on water for such a long time. It costs only $40 plus shipping fees to submit a water for competition, but a global medal at Berkeley Springs is a point of pride for any company that achieves it. That's why, sitting on my padded conference chair and listening to my water master's instruction, I felt like a fraud. Most days, water is something I barely acknowledge. It's there to be gulped, boiled, and flushed. But I needn't have worried. The Berkeley Springs International Water Tasting is designed as a tourist boon, and the only prerequisite for judgeship is enthusiasm or a byline. Nearly all of the other panelists were fellow members of the media, selected by the promoters to ensure the greatest possible coverage. About half our group had served as judges before, but as setup continued, von Wiesenberger administered a proper training, if only to ensure that we exuded the proper gravitas for the occasion. "You'll be sitting over there," he said, gesturing to the two linen-covered tables under the stage lights at the far end of the room. "The pourers will come by and give you each water in the right numbered glass. Hold the glass up, take a look for any impurities, anything floating. Now bring the glass to your nose and take a deep breath. What do you smell? Maybe it's chlorine or plastic. Then take a sip and keep the water in your mouth. How does it feel on the tongue? Is it harsh or soft? Fresh or bland? As you swallow, is it refreshing, making you thirsty for more? Or does it leave a lingering residue?" Beyond von Wiesenberger, on a small dance floor in front of the judges' tables, hundreds of the competing bottles were arranged in a flowing, multi-leveled sculpture. This year's entries included commercial and tap waters from South Korea, New Zealand, Bosnia, and Quebec, as well as domestic products ranging from Berkeley Springs' own supply to samples from rural California. The competing brand names all sounded either parodically natural: Cedar Springs, Misty Mountain, El Dorado, or shamelessly luxurious: Cellini Signature Edition, Ultra Premium Quality, Otakiri Reserve. Bottled water is poised to overtake soda as America's foremost commercial drink within the next year. Americans drank 10.9 billion gallons of it in 2014, a 7.3% increase over 2013. While plenty of that belongs to soda company behemoths like Aquafina and Dasani, the artisanal market is growing as well, and Berkeley Springs offers an annual chance for smaller companies to garner an otherwise unattainable level of industry recognition and respect. Travel Berkeley Springs, the local tourism bureau, decided in 1991 that they needed some kind of annual water festival in order to capitalize on the town's namesake natural fountains. What started as a whim then grew, almost inadvertently, into one of the most prestigious events of the $360 billion water industry. And that means Berkeley Springs, all 0.34 square miles of it, has become one of the industry's most important locations. The Saturday competition was arranged in four flights: municipal, purified, bottled, and sparkling. As we had been prepped by email in the weeks before, the latter two flights, featuring the bulk of the global prestige-seeking brands, would be held at night after a larger crowd had assembled. The afternoon flights highlighted the less glamorous products. Municipal is simple tap water from towns and cities like Abbotsford, British Columbia, and Montpelier, Ohio, looking for a point of civic pride. Montpelier, a three-time champion, hangs a "Home of the World's Best Municipal Drinking Water" sign outside its water treatment facility. Just before 2:30 p.m., the judges and I took our seats. Before the scattered, quiet crowd, a dramatically tall and expressive woman walked onto the stage. "Well, it's the opposite of warm," announced water tasting co-founder Jill Klein Roan, pointing to the windows, where we could see snow falling on this February day. "But there's so much warmth in this room." One by one, she introduced us with a hammy gratitude that reflected her four-decade career as a traveling performer. "And just like we say every year," said Klein Roan, Let the waters flow. The pourers marched out emotionlessly and offered up the municipal flight from unmarked carafes. I held the first glass up to the light, searched for any distinguishing characteristic. Alas, it looked like water. I stuck my nose in and sniffed embarrassedly. I smelled a weak hint of chlorine and then, taking my first tiny sip, sensed it on my tongue as well. Holding the water in my mouth for a few seconds, I swallowed and looked down at my judge's sheet, dutifully assigning a number value in each of the categories: appearance, odor, flavor, mouthfeel, and aftertaste. It was nothing worse than what I'd expect from my tap at home, and I gave it an 11 out of 14 in the overall category without really understanding what that meant. By the second sample, I realized just how forgiving I'd been. This one entered my mouth and felt like chilled silk. I wanted more of it immediately. I decreed with excitement, 13 out of 14. Suddenly, I felt like the water expert I was supposed to be. Berkeley Springs' own water flows through surrounding hills of silica, and some say that accounts for its extraordinary taste and texture, and for the fact that it has flowed at a constant 74.3 degrees Fahrenheit, 1,000 gallons a minute, for untold centuries. Before Europeans arrived, native tribes traveled from the Great Lakes and the Carolinas to take the waters here, and once colonists came, Berkeley Springs grew into a well-known resort destination. The town even boasts the world's only outdoor monument to presidential bathing, a hole in the ground that George Washington allegedly used to wash up in 1748. Berkeley Springs may have been the first American spa town, but it was a shadow of itself when Gene Mosier, a then 32-year-old ex-CIA employee, moved there in 1977. Mosier and her husband opened a historical museum and restored an Art Deco single-screen movie house. But the town's lap pools and stone baths went out of commission during its snowy winters. So in the early 90s, Mosier set out to establish a winter water-themed event to attract tourists. The timing was propitious. Between 1990 and 1997, when the Berkeley Springs tasting had become an institution, annual U.S. bottled water sales jumped from $115 million to $4 billion, thanks largely to public concern about obesity and water contamination. In the midst of this explosive growth, Berkeley Springs was the only town in the world hosting a gala award show to celebrate water. I finished the municipal flight, surprised at how thoroughly I'd been convinced of von Wiesenberg's premise. There was absolutely a wide range of flavors, textures, and sensations among the 22 samples, and some were obviously better tasting than others. The purified section consisted of 10 tap waters that had been refiltered and processed, the kind of thing you'd find in your average water cooler. The entrants tended to be regional home and office delivery services looking for a distinguishing accolade. By this point, I was enough of a snob to recognize that when you demineralize water, you remove any semblance of flavor or character. One after another, they were all indistinguishable. It was like trying to decide the whitest copier paper. The bottled flight was delicious and varied. Many of the waters smelled earthy and mineralized, almost like a wet cave, but they all felt airy on my tongue, even more luxurious and flavorful than the best of the municipal samples. They tasted cold, even though they weren't. The spring waters were a brand of natural miracle, so flavorful they made me despair for a lifetime of imposters I'd knowingly endured. Halfway through the 40 samples, I hit upon a few in a row that tasted relatively unimpressive, and I wondered if I'd simply gone numb from repetition. Then I took my next sip and had that same epiphanic experience that the best ones earlier in the flight had provided. I wasn't quite ready to adopt the full von Weissenberger lifestyle. He had told me his children never once drank tap, and that his dog preferred Perrier, but I could understand the appeal. I'd be fine never drinking from a faucet again. The final flight consisted of 12 sparkling waters. This wasn't your average grocery store seltzer. The bubbles were delicate and fine, like champagne, and a few of them barely tasted carbonated at all. But that also meant they were light, crisp, and less harsh on the tongue, with more room for actual mineral flavor to shine through. After I took my last sip, I was ready to sprint for the bathroom, but there would be no quick movements. By that point in the evening, the Parkview Garden Room was a party. More people, less businessmen stiffness, plus the lobby bar was now open. Klein Rohn and von Weissenberger took the mics and announced the top five municipal finishers. Hamilton, Ohio, Klein Rohn announced as the winner, scanning the room to see if they'd sent representatives. No such luck. A great cheer erupted away. For the bottled awards, Klein Rohn counted down the runners-up from Australia, Canada, Tennessee, and California before announcing that the winner came from Greece. Fengari Platinum from Athens, she shouted, with an even less hopeful look around to see if anyone was there. Athens won again in the sparkling category. Daphne Ultra Premium Quality Natural Mineral Sparkling, she read slowly from her card. She moved on to the Purified Awards. It's Indigo! Indigo H2O, she exclaimed, and we all cheered. Weeks later, I talked to Yuri Cataldo, the founder and CEO of Indigo H2O, which before this year's gold medal finish had won bronze in 2013 and silver in 2014. It is a relatively new company, founded in 2011, making it a classic Berkeley Springs International water tasting success story. But the media attention only came because Cataldo approached reporters about his newfound claim to producing the best-tasting purified water in the world. It's all about me telling people, he said. Being the best at something still means being the best, however, especially when you're the best at something every person on earth needs. To say you have an award-winning bottled water is really amazing, Cataldo explained. There aren't that many water competitions. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in BuzzFeed.com. We'll take in one of the obituaries this week. The doctor who pioneered IVF in the U.S. Howard Jones, 1910 to 2015. When Dr. Howard Jones turned 65, the mandatory retirement age at Baltimore's Johns Hopkins University, he refused to stop working. Instead, the gynecological surgeon and his wife, Georgiana, a reproductive endocrinologist, set up the country's first in vitro fertilization clinic at the Eastern Virginia Medical School in Norfolk, Virginia, in 1978. 3 years later, after 41 tries, the couple successfully fertilized a woman's egg outside the womb. America's first test tube baby, Elizabeth Carr, was born on December 28, 1981. Every year after, Jones would phone his first IVF baby on her birthday. He made sure I knew how much my parents loved me, she said, no matter the manner in which I came into the world. Growing up in Baltimore, the young Jones often went on house calls with his physician father in their horse and buggy, said the New York Times. He met Georgiana while studying at Johns Hopkins Medical School. Coincidentally, his father had delivered him at birth, and joined the school's acclaimed hospital after graduating. One of his most notable patients was Henrietta Lacks, a cervical cancer patient whose tumor cells would controversially be cultured in the 1950s to create the first immortal cancer cell line for medical research. Jones also became known for his work on genital anomalies, said the Baltimore Sun. He performed surgery on intersexual patients, such as genetic females born with male genitalia, and in 1965, co-founded the first U.S. sex change clinic at Johns Hopkins. The Jones IVF clinic in Norfolk initially met with resistance from some who were concerned about the ethics of test tube babies, said the Washington Post. But the practice soon gained widespread acceptance. Some 4,000 babies have now been born with the clinic's help. And in 1984, he was even invited to the Vatican to advise Pope John Paul II on reproductive technology. Jones continued to keep office hours at the Institute even after he was 100, said the Associated Press. But the gynecologist stopped working with patients in the early 1990s. After Georgiana developed Alzheimer's. When she stopped seeing patients, I decided to stop too, he said. Without her, it wasn't fun anymore. Take a look at the health and science page now. First, our galaxy may contain 1 billion Earths. NASA astronomers suggest that the Milky Way may be home to as many as 1 billion Earths, rocky planets of roughly similar size that orbit sun-like stars and have surfaces suitable for sustaining water and life. NASA's Kepler Space Observatory, which has focused on one small patch of star-studded sky for the past 6 years, has already identified 4,696 of these planets. One of them, dubbed Kepler-452b, is the most Earth-like planet ever found outside the solar system. Circling a 6-billion-year-old yellow dwarf star comparable to the Sun, the planet is about 1,400 light-years away. Too remote to be directly observed. But the spacecraft has determined that Kepler-452b is approximately 60% greater in diameter and 5 times more massive than Earth. And that's a year that lasts 385 days. It's unclear if it's made of rock, but astronomers believe Kepler-452b has a thicker atmosphere than Earth and twice the gravitational pull. All told, researchers estimate that 14 billion of the galaxy's 100 billion stars host planets that could support life. The vast majority of these planets may differ strikingly from our own, but like Earth, they orbit the so-called Goldilocks zone, the region where conditions are just right for the formation of water. Nevertheless, it's one thing to know how common planets are in the habitable zone, Natalie Batala, Kepler's lead scientist, tells National Geographic. It's a completely different thing to know how many of them are living worlds. The health scare of the week, beware of added sugars. Drinking just one sugary soda a day increases the risk for type 2 diabetes, whether or not you're obese, new research suggests. After analyzing 17 respected studies, a team at the University of Cambridge found that downing a single sugary sweetened drink every 24 hours boosts the odds of developing the chronic disease by 13%, even if the people are lean, the study's author, Fumiaki Imamura, tells NPR.org. The researchers estimate that if Americans broke their daily sugary drink habit, 2 million new cases of diabetes could be prevented over the next 5 years. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, meanwhile, is also taking aim at sugars, proposing that nutritional labels on packaged foods indicate the amount of added sugar they contain as a percentage of the recommended daily calorie intake, reports Bloomberg.com. Health officials advise that daily calories from added sugar should not exceed 10% of total calories. One 20-ounce soda typically contains about 66 grams of sugar, 130% of the prescribed daily value. On the Talking Points page, Biden, why he might challenge Hillary. Back in 2008, Democratic presidential frontrunner Hillary Clinton lost the mantle of inevitability to one Barack Obama, said Josh Greenman in the New York Daily News. 7 years later, could the president's good friend Joe inflict the same damage by mounting his own insurgent campaign? Speculation that Vice President Joe Biden is about to jump into the 2016 race is rife, after New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd revealed that while he was on his deathbed in May, Biden's late son Beau had urged his father to run. Beau's plea has had a profound effect on his father's thinking, said John Heilman in Bloomberg.com. But equally significant is Biden's mounting sense of dismay about the Clintons. Like a growing portion of the general public, Biden has been put off by Hillary's enthusiastic money-making activities and her evasive email shenanigans. If Hillary's support really starts caving in, Democrats will want a viable alternative. Biden would offer one. It's a fascinating proposition, said the Boston Herald in an editorial. Uncle Joe is well-liked because he exudes the very qualities Hillary lacks, warmth, candor, and authenticity. But the vice president's lack of guile makes him incredibly gaffe-prone. His Bidenisms include subjecting women to unsolicited shoulder massages during public ceremonies and dropping a celebratory F-bomb near an open microphone when Obama signed the Affordable Care Act. Face it, Biden doesn't stand a chance, said Nate Silver in 538.com. The vice president has no campaign staff, no natural constituency, and at 72, he would be the oldest president to serve a first term. Hillary, by contrast, is an icon to rank-and-file Democrats and has a unique selling point. She'd be the first woman president. Oh, and Clinton has already raised $68 million. Still, said Josh Voorhees in Slate.com, it's worth considering just how much Biden would fundamentally alter the Democratic race just by entering it. Until now, Clinton has been carefully towing the line between establishment and liberal Democrats, studiously ignoring certain controversial subjects that could lose her support in either camp, such as Wall Street regulation or the Keystone Pipeline. But the entry of the overtly liberal Biden would finally force her to pick a lane, transforming her inevitable coronation into a head-to-head slugfest. If Biden runs, Hillary loses, even if she wins. As we come up on the beginning of the school year, here are a couple of anecdotes from the Only in America section. A second grader at an Indiana public school was banished by his teacher after telling his classmates that he didn't believe in God. The seven-year-old was forced to sit by himself during lunch for 3 days and not speak to other students because, the teacher said, his views on religion had offended them. His parents have filed a lawsuit. At a New York City high school, student has complained she was awarded a diploma despite failing grades so the school could bolster its graduation rate. Melissa Mejia says she was given a passing grade in her government class even though she hadn't done the work. Her teacher admitted being under tremendous pressure to meet academic goals and said it was in the school's best interest to pass her. And a few other random short notes. Donors contributed $275, $2.5 million to GOP-aligned super PACs in the first 6 months of this year. more than four times the $67 million raised by Republican candidates through their official campaigns. Now that wealthy donors can give unlimited sums to PACs, said Henry Barbour, a veteran GOP fundraiser, a handful of people really can have a material impact on the race. An estimated 15,000 ISIS fighters have been killed in more than 5,500 U.S.-led airstrikes, and the terror group must now avoid putting groups of its soldiers in the open. But U.S. intelligence officials said ISIS has replaced its dead with new recruits and still has 20,000 to 30,000 fighters. India's population is projected to equal China's by 2022, when each country will have 1.4 billion people, according to a new United Nations study. Since 2007, Hillary and Bill Clinton have earned $141 million and paid more taxes, $57.5 million, than the $38 million Jeb Bush made from 1981 to 2013. About 30% of all high-speed police chases end in crashes, and nearly half of the people killed are not the suspects being pursued. At least 11,506 people were killed in such crashes in the U.S. from 1979 to 2013, including 2,456 bystanders. On the poll watch, Americans are divided over and confused about the Iran nuclear deal. 35% support the deal, 33% oppose it, and 32% admit they do not know enough to have an opinion. Democrats support it by a 58% to 8% margin, while Republicans oppose it 60% to 15%. And we'll finish up the day with a quote from one of my favorite authors, John Updike. He says, "Most of American life is driving somewhere and then driving back and wondering where the hell you went." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.